Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for November 7, 2022. Just hours left in campaign 2022, candidates across the country are making their final appeal to voters. And according to data from local election officials, Edison Research, and Catalyst, more than 41 million ballots have already been cast across 47 states. Texas leading the nation in early voting with more than 5 million ballots cast. Florida is second with 4.7 million ballots cast. And then California with more than 4.1 million. This evening, President Biden will be at Bowie State University in Maryland at an event hosted by the Democratic National Committee on behalf of Democratic gubernatorial candidate Wes Moore. Meanwhile, former President Donald Trump campaigns in Ohio for Republican candidates, including U.S. Senate candidate J.D. Vance and Governor Mike DeWine. Twitter CEO Elon Musk urging followers to cast their ballots for Republicans this year. In a post, he wrote, "Shared power curbs the worst excesses of both parties. Therefore, I recommend voting for Republican Congress, given that the presidency is Democratic." The post was retweeted more than 70,000 times in just 30 minutes. And we begin in Yonkers, New York, just north of New York City, where President Joe Biden campaigned on Sunday for Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul, who was in a close race against Republican challenger Lee Zeldin.
One of those inflection points, I mean it sincerely, where what's going to happen the next couple years is going to have more to do with what this country looks like 20 years from now than anything else. You know, let's be clear. This will... Well, let Joe talk, okay? Look. This election isn't a referendum, it's a choice. It's a choice between two fundamentally different visions of America. I've said from the beginning, my objective when I ran was to build an economy from the bottom up and the middle out. And I tell you what, it's a fundamental shift, and it's working compared to the MAGA, mega Republican trickle-down economics. You saw what happened last time under my predecessor. The economy left it in ruins. He's the first president in America since Herbert Hoover to lose more jobs than he got than he had when he came to office. Fewer jobs, an unemployment rate, 6.4%. He lost manufacturing jobs. Hundreds of small businesses closed in this state alone, let alone around the nation, thousands. And the country in a pandemic with no way out. By the time I got sworn in, only 3.5 million people have been vaccinated, fully vaccinated. Now there are 220 million we got done. So we moved. Our approach is working. Since I came to office, we've created 10 million brand new jobs. The unemployment rate is a historic low of 3.7%. And we're making things here in America again. We're shipping American products overseas instead of American jobs overseas. We've created 700,000 new manufacturing jobs. And by the way, where the hell's it written to say we can't be the manufacturing capital of the world again? I'm not joking. Where's that written? I signed in a law, the bipartisan infrastructure law. By the way, the governor's opponent, Zeldin, voted against that. But as the governor said, she's still fixing the roads and bridges in his district, even though he's against it. But he'll probably take credit for it somewhere along the line. The most significant investment in our nation's infrastructure since Eisenhower's interstate highway system. And your governor is making sure all that money coming to New York, and it's billions, is getting out the door right away. She's repairing roads, bridges, building New York's electric vehicle charging stations, expanding access to high-speed internet, cleaning up the water systems. You know, she's helping New York lead the way of making things in America.
President Biden on Sunday, the first presidential appearance in Yonkers, New York in nearly 50 years. Tonight, the president will be at Bowie State University in Maryland at an event hosted by the Democratic National Committee. He's campaigning for Democratic gubernatorial candidate Wes Moore. That event begins at 7 p.m. Eastern. We'll have it live here for you on C-SPAN Radio. Also on Sunday, former President Donald Trump held a rally at the Miami-Dade County Fairgrounds in Florida. He was stumping for Republican Senator Marco Rubio, who is running for a third term against Democratic challenger Val Demings. Here's former President Trump.
Our country's in serious danger. One thing I've learned very strongly is I've dealt with all of the leaders, and I get along with them, and we were tough. I renegotiated trade deals. I mean, they couldn't have loved me too much. I got them to pay for NATO $430 billion. They were all delinquent, almost all of them. And they had to pay $430 billion. I said, no, we're not going to. They said, sir, does that mean you will not protect us if we don't pay? One of the presidents of one of the countries, 28 countries. And they said, does that mean that you're not going to? I said, that's what it means. If you're delinquent, real estate term, if you're delinquent, you don't get protection. So he said, you mean if Russia came and attacked us, you will not protect us if we don't pay? That's right. Exactly right. You understood it. The next day, like $400 billion came in. It was rather amazing. Now, if I would have done the typical political thing, no, we'll always protect you, I promise. What's the purpose of their paying? They wouldn't pay. Marco knew about that. I talked to Marco about that. He understood it better than anybody. Under my leadership, we had, for the first time, American energy independence and even American energy dominance. We were going to be dominant in a matter of months. We were going to be bigger than Russia and Saudi Arabia combined. I'd say that's pretty good. And when he came in, he just said, no, that's it. Now they're begging for oil. It's so sad. Now you take a look at what's happened where Biden goes and pleads with OPEC. And now it's called OPEC Plus. You know that, right? Because it's OPEC Plus, Plus, Plus. Everybody wants to be a member. You didn't even hear the term OPEC because I had basically wiped out. For 4 years, you never heard OPEC even mentioned. We had so much oil, we had the opposite problem. The price got so low, we had to save the oil companies. We had so much. We were $1.87 a gallon for gasoline. Think of that, $1.87. Now today in California, they just broke $8 a gallon, and the rest of you are going to follow. Don't forget, we filled up these strategic reserves, which is something a president doesn't want to do. But when the price per barrel got so low, we made a deal, and 75 million barrels, all of that's being dissipated, and we're almost empty. And it's not supposed to be used for that. It's supposed to be used for military emergencies, real big, not for getting the price of gasoline down so that people can get a couple of more votes in an election, which is what they're doing.
Former President Donald Trump speaking Sunday evening in Florida. Tonight, he'll be in Vandalia, Ohio, which is near Dayton, for Republican candidates, including U.S. Senate candidate J.D. Vance and Governor Mike DeWine. That's scheduled to begin about 8 p.m. Eastern. It'll also be live here on C-SPAN Radio. Earlier today, Rachel Arie of the Bipartisan Policy Center spoke about her organization's recent report on election security in this year's midterm elections.
We wrote this report because over the last couple weeks and months leading up to the midterm election, there has been so much controversy around the people in place running our elections. And it is so easy for us to start to feel doubtful when we have these reports being made that the poll workers and the election officials are somehow being infiltrated by election deniers. What we wanted to do was show all of the protections in place that we have protecting our system against what's being called insider threats. You know, those threats are certainly real, but what we wanted to bring to light was why Americans should still trust the voting process.
Okay, so what are some of the protections in place that people need to know about?
Yeah, so a couple of the key ones we tracked were, one, training requirements for poll workers. 42 states and D.C. require training at the state level for all temporary election workers. Those that don't, either they're vote-by-mail states and they don't have traditional polling sites and therefore have slightly different training requirements. Others delegate training to the local level, but still we see the vast majority of states having these kinds of protections in place. Also, codes of conduct, making sure that temporary election workers know what is and is not allowed to be done. And in accordance with that, having rules for dismissal. So if a poll worker violates current standing policy or regulation, they would be removed from their post. And finally, partisan parity requirements. The vast majority of states require that state and local election offices strive for balance in the political makeup of their poll workers. This helps add a layer of transparency and accountability to the poll worker process.
Let me just go through those again and show the states that you were talking about. 42 states and D.C. require election worker training in state law. This is what the map looks like. 42 states and D.C. require temporary election workers to take oaths of office, and 47 states strive for partisan parity when hiring election workers. Let's start with that last one. So they strive for partisan parity. Why? And what are these election workers doing? Where do they get to stand? What do they get to do?
Yeah, so it's a little bit elusive. So we discussed it in terms of poll workers, because that's when most of the public talks about temporary election workers. They're thinking of the people when you show up at a polling place on election day, the person who's checking you in, helping you cast or scan your ballot, those types of things. But temporary election workers work throughout the election process. They do voter check-in. They assist in voter registration. They sometimes assist in counting and auditing votes. They really help support all aspects of election administration, because it is quite a cyclical endeavor. Every election, the EAC reports that we need about 750,000 temporary election workers to support election operations. So this is a huge endeavor. And adding in that partisan balance helps make sure that both parties feel that they have a voice and transparency into how elections work. Now, as Americans kind of segregate themselves into political geographies, it is increasingly difficult for election officials to achieve partisan balance in their temporary election workers. But that has actually been getting a little bit easier since the 2020 election. We've seen a little bit more involvement from local Republican parties in helping election offices recruit temporary election workers. That is sometimes for better and sometimes for worse. One, it helps us maintain that partisan parity. On the other hand, it does create an opening for, when there's sponsored trainings for temporary election workers that exist outside of state or local official training. They sometimes get different information. Going into the Michigan primary, we did see some GOP training for poll watchers, directing them to, sneak cell phones in or in other ways violate existing law for that state.
So, Rich, you said that did you say threats are real? And if so, what are they?
Yeah, so a lot of the threats that have been discussed lately are the risk that we see organizations like True the Vote or the Election Integrity Network, organizations that are quite outwardly and vigorously espousing lies about the results of the 2020 election. We have seen them increasingly trying to recruit and train temporary election workers with the pretty explicit aim of trying to unearth fraud. And so we have seen some in very isolated cases, poll workers at the end of the day saying that they aren't going to, tabulate votes in the machine, that they're just going to hand count all the ballots that were cast. Thankfully, because of bipartisan presence of poll workers, efforts like that have so far been thwarted. In the Michigan primary, one poll worker was charged with tampering with election equipment. He inserted a personal flash drive into the electronic poll book. Thankfully, that electronic poll book does not interact at all with tabulation equipment, and that instance was quickly identified and addressed, and he was ultimately charged. But it is that kind of ongoing risk that as we have the people who are interacting with voters or interacting with voting equipment not believing the results of the election, I think there is some valid concern that those folks might in some way attempt to undermine election results. But at the same time, we have not seen, other than that kind of one instance in Michigan, have not seen any widespread indication that this is happening. And really what we've seen is that the 750,000 temporary election workers are responsible and they're committed to preserving American democracy.
And they receive training, as you talked about. Yes. What kind of training do they get? How long does it last?
It really depends by the state and even by the locality. In Maricopa County, for example, temporary election workers go through 2 full days of training, which is pretty amazing. We think of that as kind of the gold standard. They learn about everything from how polling places work, where equipment needs to be put, how to check in voters. And depending on kind of what they're assisting with, they will get the really technical background. Justin Roebuck in Michigan, he is the county clerk for Ottawa County. He is a member of our Task Force on Elections, which is a group of state and local election officials from around the country. He is increasingly discussing some of these insider threats risks in his poll worker training, helping poll workers, one, know what they need to do to help support, kind of elections and democracy, and identify any risk of insider threats. I will say one concern is that, resources are really at the heart of a lot of the election administration problems that we have. And when states aren't themselves, you know, paying for and supporting training for election workers, and when it goes down to the local, likely resource-strapped county or local jurisdiction, they're sometimes disincentivized, because if they have to pay temporary election workers to attend training, and then if they want to do a long training, they have to pay more, and they might not have the resources to do that. So there is some kind of structural discrepancies in terms of how training takes place that we can address in the longer term.
What about early voting and mail-in absentee votes? Are there election workers that deal with the opening of those ballots or the counting of those ballots?
Yeah, so there are temporary election workers that assist in things like verifying the identity of the male voter. Typically, in most states, that's done by verifying the signature on that mail ballot envelope. States, by and large, do have vigorous training for those individuals, and it's almost always done by a bipartisan group of individuals who are verifying that signature. When it comes down to actually interacting with the ballots, there is a much higher standard for training and vetting for those temporary election workers. Early voting, it depends a little bit whether it's in person, like polling place style, or whether it's more by mail, in which case the training would kind of be more similar to the election day style or be more like mail voting.
Rachel Oree is the Associate Director of the Bipartisan Policy Center's Elections Project on C-SPAN's Washington Journal. You can find the full segment at cspan.org/Washington Journal. Washington Today continues in a moment. Welcome back to Washington Today. Here are some more of today's headlines. The United Nations Climate Summit kicked off in Egypt today, and UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres telling world leaders, quote, "We are on a highway to climate hell with our foot on the accelerator," adding that either developed and developing countries work together to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and set the world on a low carbon path, or fail, which would bring climate breakdown and catastrophe. More from the Secretary General in a moment. A Russian businessman who's been accused of running internet troll farms to sway U.S. politics admitted for the first time that he has interfered in U.S. elections and would continue to do so in the future. In comments posted on Russian social media, Yevgeny Prigozhin said, quote, "We have interfered in U.S. elections, we are interfering, and we will continue to interfere. Carefully, accurately, surgically, and in our own way, as we know how to do." It was a second major admission in recent months by the 61-year-old businessman, who is often referred to as Putin's chef because his catering company operates Kremlin contracts. The comment was posted in response to a request from a Russian news site. We'll hear U.S. reaction to the comment coming up. North Korea's military said its recent missile tests are practiced to strike key South Korean and U.S. targets. The North Koreans launched dozens of missiles and warplanes last week over the ocean, triggering evacuation alerts in some South Korean and Japanese areas. The move was seen as in response to massive U.S.-South Korean Air Force drills that the North views as an invasion rehearsal. U.S. and South Korean officials strongly condemned the North missile launches, saying the drills were defensive in nature. Delegates from nearly 200 countries began the UN Climate Summit in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt, yesterday. The two-week-long meeting started with an agreement to discuss a controversial topic. Should rich nations compensate poorer nations that are most vulnerable to climate change? The agreement came following a dire warning in the opening remarks by UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
"In just days, our planet's population will cross a new threshold. The 8 billionth member of our human family will be born. This milestone puts into perspective what this climate conference is all about. How will we answer when baby 8 billion is old enough to ask, 'What did you do for our world and for our planet when you had the chance?'" Excellencies, this UN Climate Conference is a reminder that the answer is in our hands. And the clock is ticking. We are in the fight of our lives, and we are losing. Greenhouse gas emissions keep growing. Global temperatures keep rising. And our planet is fast approaching tipping points that will make climate chaos irreversible. We are on a highway to climate hell with our foot still on the accelerator. The war in Ukraine, other conflicts, have caused so much bloodshed and violence and had dramatic impacts all over the world. But we cannot accept that our attention is not focused on climate change. We must, of course, work together to support peace efforts and end the tremendous suffering. But climate change is on a different timeline and a different scale. It is a defining issue of our age. It is the central challenge of our century. It is unacceptable, outrageous, and self-defeating to put it on the back burner. Indeed, many of today's conflicts are linked with growing climate chaos. And the war in Ukraine has exposed the profound risks of our fossil fuel addiction. And today's crisis cannot be an excuse for backsliding or greenwashing. If anything, they are a reason for greater urgency, stronger action, and effective accountability.
United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres speaking at the opening of the UN Climate Summit in Egypt. For more than a decade, wealthy nations have rejected official discussions on funds to help poor countries cope with global warming's impacts. New United Kingdom Prime Minister Rishi Sunak spoke about that issue.
I know that for many, finances are tough right now. The pandemic all but broke the global economy. And before coming here today, I spent last week working on the difficult decisions needed to ensure confidence and economic stability in my own country. But I can tell you today that the United Kingdom is delivering on our commitment of £11.6 billion. And as part of this, we will now triple our funding on adaptation to £1.5 billion by 2025. But let me tell you why. First, I profoundly believe it is the right thing to do. Listen to Prime Minister Motley of Barbados as she describes the existential threat posed by the ravages of climate change. Or look at the devastating floods in Pakistan, where the area underwater is the same size as the entire United Kingdom. When you see 33 million people displaced, with disease rife and spreading through the water, you know it is morally right to honour our promises.
United Kingdom Prime Minister Rishi Sunak at the UN Climate Summit in Egypt. Former Vice President Al Gore represented the U.S. at Sunday's opening ceremonies. President Biden is scheduled to attend the conference on Friday. A Russian businessman who's been accused of running internet troll farms to sway U.S. politics admitted for the first time he has interfered in U.S. elections and would continue to do so in the future. In comments posted on Russian social media, Yevgeny Prigozhin said, quote, "We have interfered in U.S. elections. We are interfering, and we will continue to interfere carefully, accurately, surgically, and in our own way, as we know how to do." Second major admission in recent months by the 61-year-old businessman. Comment posted in response to a request from a Russian news site. State Department spokesman in the U.S., Ned Price, asked about it at today's briefing.
I just want to ask you about this quote-unquote admission by Mr. Prigozhin, Russia, that that they have interfered, they will continue to interfere in U.S. elections, and what you make of it, if anything.
Well, I suppose his own statements didn't tell us anything we didn't already know. His bold confession, if anything, appears to be just a manifestation of the impunity that crooks and cronies enjoy under President Putin and the Kremlin. As you know, we have sanctioned this individual, Yevgeny Prigozhin, since 2018 for his interference in with our election processes and institutions. In March of 2018, the Department of the Treasury designated the Internet Research Agency and Prigozhin himself. This designation targeted malicious cyber actors, including those involved in interfering with the election process and institutions. On September 20th of 2019, Treasury, under the auspices of OFAC, also took action against Russian actors that attempted to influence the 2018 midterm elections, including previously designated person Yevgeny Prigozhin, as well as the employees of the Internet Research Agency, which Prigozhin himself finances. In July of this year, we put forward a so-called Reward for Justice, or RFJ, seeking information on interference in U.S. elections by the Internet Research Agency, by Prigozhin, and related Russian entities, offering up to $10 million for information on foreign interference in U.S. elections. We all know, especially today, but every day, the free and fair elections are cornerstone of American society, of American democracy. We won't tolerate interference in our elections, regardless of where it comes from. We've demonstrated that not only with our words, but with our deeds. In addition to the sanctions against Prigozhin, against the IRA, this administration has announced sanctions against Russia. We did so in April of 2021 in response not only to Russia's malicious cyber attack in the context of SolarWinds, in the context of what it had done to Mr. Navalny with the chemical weapons attack, what it was doing to Mr. Navalny's supporters, but also in response to its interference in our elections. We've done the same against Iran. We are prepared to do the same against any other state or entity that would seek to interfere in our democratic processes.
State Department spokesman Ned Price being questioned by Matt Lee from the Associated Press at today's briefing. Reminder, starting at 8 p.m. Eastern tomorrow, we'll have live election night coverage. And to see which party will control Congress, you'll hear the results as they happen from House, Senate, governor's races from around the country, including victory and concession speeches from the candidates. Listen here on C-SPAN Radio, watch on C-SPAN Television, or follow us on the C-SPAN Now app. And watch on demand and explore all the results on our website, cspan.org/campaign2022. And at today's White House briefing, the press secretary Karine Jean-Pierre confirming President Biden plans to speak about the election results on Wednesday.
Just some housekeeping to start. Can you give us a sense of what the president will be doing tomorrow on Election Day, tomorrow night, and if he has any plans to make an address on Wednesday after the results?
So a couple of things there I'll lay out for you all tomorrow and also on Tuesday. So tomorrow and Tuesday, the president will have a full schedule here at the White House. As I previously said, we expect the president will address the elections the day afterwards. And when we have details on the timing of that, we, of course, will share it with all of you. But I also just want to note, as you all know, because you guys have covered this these past couple of years, in 2022, it took 2 weeks to call every state. In modern elections, more and more ballots are being cast in early voting and also by mail. And many states don't start counting those ballots until after the ballots, after the polls close on November 8th. So you heard the president say this the other night. He has been very clear on this as well. We may not know all the winners of elections for a few days. It takes time to count all legitimate ballots in a legal and orderly manner. That's how this is supposed to work. And it's important for us to all be patient while votes are being counted. This is not just for all of you, but this is also for the folks who are watching. And so I think it's important to just remind folks that's something that people should be mindful of as well.
The White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre with reporters at today's briefing. And one more note, you can hear how past presidents responded to midterm elections on our podcast, The Weekly. That's our weekly look into the C-SPAN video library. The episode is Thumping and Shellacking, Presidents React to Midterm Elections. Starts with Bill Clinton's reaction in 1994 through Donald Trump's in 2018. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Just search C-SPAN The Weekly. And thanks for listening to Washington Today. Get the stories Washington is talking about delivered to your inbox every day by subscribing to C-SPAN's evening newsletter word for word. Sign up at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.